Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back to the program designed to help you learn and improve your American English. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today, we are going to make some money. We will visit a place not far from the VOA studios to find out how U.S. paper money is made. We will also learn how officials protect the real money from being imitated by counterfeiters. But first, the story of some things that may be more valuable than money to some people who once lived in Iraq. Maurice Shohet is looking through a box filled with old black and white photos. The pictures recall his days in Baghdad, Iraq. Mr. Shohet grew up in the Iraqi capital among one of the world's oldest Jewish communities. About 150,000 Jews once lived in Iraq. The photos show family celebrations, including weddings and bar mitzvahs, coming-of-age ceremonies. In one picture, he and his mother and brothers are in a rowboat floating on the waters of the Tigris River. The Shohet family fled Iraq in 1970, after Jews became unwelcome in the country. They left on foot at night during the rule of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. But Mr. Shohet still praises his former nation.
I love Iraq because I was born and raised there. The people are wonderful. We cannot equate what happened at the time by the Ba'ath regime with reflecting everybody.
Mr. Shohet loaned his book of family photos to go with an exhibit seen first at the National Archives in Washington. The exhibit of religious books and community documents now is in the National Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York City. American soldiers looking for nuclear weapons discovered the objects in the flooded lowest floor of the Mikhabarat. The agency served as Saddam Hussein's intelligence service. More than 2,700 books and documents were recovered from the Mikhabarat headquarters. They included many pieces from the Torah, the first five books of Jewish scriptures or writings. The soldiers found a case for the holy book. They discovered documents as old as the 16th century. Many were published in Baghdad, but some came from faraway places like Venice. The soldiers who rescued the objects found them wet and with pages stuck together and covered with mold. Doris Hamburg directed the effort to save the objects. She said they had to be frozen immediately. And even though war was taking place around them, the rescuers found a freezer vehicle.
They were able, believe it or not, to find a freezer truck in this very difficult circumstances in Baghdad.
The documents are to be shipped to Iraq this year after they are repaired and restored. The U.S. State Department says it has trained Iraqi archivists to make sure the collection is protected in Baghdad. But Iraqi Jews living in the United States say the American government had no right to promise to return the objects. Iraq's ambassador offered to delay the return of the objects. He made the proposal to the Jewish Daily Forward. But for Maurice Shohet, that is not enough. He says Iraqi Jews were never asked about the agreement. He says the objects were taken from the Jewish people and still belong to them.
So it has to be returned to the community. Since there is no community left in Iraq, only five people who are afraid even to meet each other.
The exhibit of religious books and community documents at the National Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York City will be open until May 18th of this year. American dollars are popular both in the United States and around the world. For more than a century and a half, the U.S. Department of the Treasury has worked to make sure that the banknotes are real. The department wants people to know their currency, their paper money, has value. The Bureau of Engraving and Printing is part of the Department of the Treasury. The Bureau designs and produces millions of U.S. paper bank notes at two centers. One is in Texas, and the other is here in Washington, D.C. The Bureau is among the largest printing operations of money in the world. The agency was established in 1862 during the Civil War. At the time, Abraham Lincoln, America's 16th president, was in office. Today, Bureau Director Larry Felix says creating a banknote from start to finish requires a number of steps and systems.
It looks like ink on paper, and it is ink on paper, but there are an extraordinary amount of systems that are on that banknote.
The background color is put on during the first part of the process. For example, the Bureau's offset printing machines put the blue eagle and the orange and green colors on the background of a $20 bill. Next, the notes are pressed onto plates containing ink and engraving. A kind of design called intaglio is used for pictures, numbers, and lettering. These and other additions are different for the banknotes of differing value. Just about anyone who produces a banknote wants to put intaglio on that note. It gives banknotes a distinctive touch and feel.
The United States puts more intaglio than almost any other country because we put intaglio on the front and on the back.
The next step involves the letterpress printing process. In this process, numbers and seals of the money are added.
So we put these features in these notes to assist people to make sure that they can tell if the note is real.
Mr. Felix says the Bureau is always guarding against threats of counterfeit or false notes. He says the Bureau has designed special ways to protect the banknotes. These methods use digital and other developing technologies. Mr. Felix says there is no such thing as a note that cannot be made counterfeit. But he says the counterfeit notes in use amount to less than 0.01%. U.S. Treasurer Rosie Rios agrees that the percentage of false notes in circulation is very small. But she says the government continues to redesign American currency to prevent counterfeit. Ms. Rios pointed to the example of the $100 note. The note was recently designed with a special security feature.
One of the first things you notice about this new $100 bill is that it has this blue 3D security ribbon.
The ribbon and other new security additions make it easier for the public to make sure that the note is real. And they make it harder for criminals to counterfeit.
U.S. currency is trusted worldwide. People recognize it. And so we want to make sure that we produce something that's trusted, that's secure, that's safe, and people can continue to use in the future.
Rosie Rios' job includes watching over both the Bureau of Engraving and Printing and the U.S. Mint. They are separate agencies within the Treasury Department. The Mint produces coins, metal money. A copy of Ms. Rios' signature appears on every American note. Before we leave you, we'd like to help out a listener who wanted to know the history of dental floss. It seems that in the early 1800s, a dentist named Levi Speer Parmley from New Orleans, Louisiana, told his patients to use a thin silk thread in order to better clean around their teeth and gums. Dentists in the U.S. still recommend brushing and flossing your teeth every day. That's all for now, but stay tuned because more Learning English programs are headed your way, And there is world news at the beginning of each hour on VOA. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. American colleges and universities have a new program to give foreign engineering students a chance to study and work in the United States. It is called the Charles M. Vest Grand Challenges for Engineering International Scholarship Program. The Grand Challenges are 14 big problems that could be solved by engineers in the 21st century. They include making energy from the sun more economical, providing more clean water, preventing nuclear terror, and making better medicines. 8 American universities each offered one VEST scholarship in 2014. Rich Miller is the president of Franklin W. Olin College of Engineering in Massachusetts. He talks about the type of VEST scholars Olin College is seeking.
The concept is to try to find very highly gifted individuals who are likely to make a difference in their generation. They're up-and-comers, people who are in graduate school now, who have ambitions to make a difference on a large scale. We believe that the next generation, in order to achieve that vision, are going to have to work across the globe.
The first class of VEST scholars has already been selected. Applicants must propose a one-year research and study plan connected to one of the grand challenges. Applications for the next class are being accepted now at www.vestscholars.org. Another program for young foreign engineers is Frontiers of Engineering, organized by the National Academy of Engineering. Young engineers from 30 to 45 years old come together to listen to presentations about the newest developments in all types of engineering. 2 engineers who study earthquakes in the United States and India met at a Frontiers of Engineering meeting in the United States in 2012. Nicholas Luco, with the United States Geological Survey, talked about designing nuclear power plants that can withstand earthquakes.
Make sure that you design for some ground motion that has a small chance of happening. We want to be pretty conservative. But this newer method goes beyond that and says we want to really be able to quantify what is the chance of damage to the power plant, what level of ground shaking should we designed for.
C.S. Manohar is an engineer from Bangalore, India, who listened to Mr. Luco and invited him to come to India. Both of these engineers want stronger building rules to deal with the risk of earthquakes in all buildings, not just nuclear power plants. These engineers are now looking for money to pay for further cooperation. But already, Mr. Manohar says,
actually, it has not translated into any specific action, but even the mere awareness is also very important.
Building awareness and connections is what the Frontiers of Engineering program is all about. The Frontiers of Engineering meetings are planned for and by younger engineers. There is a meeting in India in May, one in Japan in June, and one in California in September. This has been the Learning English Education Report. I'm Karen.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. This week, we continue the story of the presidency of Andrew Jackson. Jackson took office in 1829. He was popular with many voters. They saw him as the symbol of the common man. But Jackson's first term seemed to be mostly a political battle with his vice president, John C. Calhoun. As his presidency went on, another struggle began. This time, it was Jackson against the Bank of the United States. The first Bank of the United States had closed in 1811. But without a central bank, the country's finances had suffered during the War of 1812. So in 1816, Congress provided money to establish the Second Bank of the United States. The bank could provide loans, pay bills, collect taxes, and move money around the country. Congress gave the bank a charter to do business for 20 years. The government owned one-fifth of the bank. A small group of private citizens owned the rest. Lawmakers gave the bank enormous power. The Bank of the United States had $35 million in capital. Some of that money came from the government. Most came from investors. Historian Bray Hammond notes that at the time, the Bank of the United States was the richest corporation in the world. The Bank of the United States also printed the country's paper money, and it was the only bank permitted to have offices across the nation. By making it easy or difficult for businesses to borrow money, the bank's owners could control the economy in almost any part of the United States.
What this means is that you are granting, and Congress did grant, exclusive privileges to the Bank of the United States, which meant exclusive money-making opportunities to its stockholders.
Historian Daniel Feller explains that the Bank of the United States helped the government to do its business effectively and efficiently, but it also helped the people who owned stock in the bank. During Jackson's presidency, a man named Nicholas Biddle led the Bank of the United States. Biddle was an extremely intelligent man. He had completed his studies at the University of Pennsylvania when he was only 13 years old. When he was 18, he was sent to Paris as secretary to the American minister. During America's war with Britain in 1812, Biddle helped establish the Bank of the United States. He became its president when he was only 37 years old. Biddle clearly understood his power as president of the Bank of the United States. In his mind, the government had no right to interfere in any way with the bank's business. President Jackson did not agree, nor was he very friendly toward the bank. Not many people from Western states were. They did not trust the bank's paper money. They wanted to deal in gold and silver. Jackson criticized the bank in each of his yearly messages to Congress. He said the Bank of the United States was dangerous to the liberty of the people. He said the bank could build up or pull down political parties through loans to politicians. Jackson opposed giving the bank a new charter. He proposed that a new bank be formed as part of the Treasury Department. The president urged Congress to consider the future of the bank long before the bank's charter was to end in 1836. Then, if the charter was rejected, the bank could close its business slowly over several years. Changing the banking system slowly, Jackson said, would prevent serious economic problems for the country. But the bank's president wanted to renew the charter early. He made the request in January 1832, 9 months before the next presidential election. Jackson's opponent, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky, was sure that the issue of the bank could win him some votes. Clay argued his case on the floor of the Senate for 3 days. He strongly urged the Senate to renew the bank's charter. He said the country was in the middle of a revolution, not yet a bloody revolution, but things were happening that pointed to a total change of the pure Republican character of the government. Power was being centered in the hands of one man, he said. He meant President Jackson. Clay added that if Congress did not act, the government would fail. Clay then asked the Senate to condemn Jackson, saying he violated the Constitution and the nation's laws. The Senate approved the resolution. The chief opponent to the bank was Senator Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri. He objected to the renewal of the charter, he told the Senate, because the bank was too great and powerful and made the rich richer and the poor poorer. The Senate finally voted on the bank's new charter. The vote was 28 for renewal and 20 against. The House voted 3 weeks later. It also approved the charter, 107-85. The lawmakers sent the bill to the White House. President Jackson debated it with members of his cabinet. Some wanted to negotiate a compromise, but Jackson decided to veto the bill in the strongest possible language. On July 10, 1832, Jackson sent a message to Congress explaining his reasoning. Jackson said he did not believe the bank's charter was constitutional. Jackson also spoke of the way the bank moved money from west to east. He said the bank was owned by a small group of rich men, mostly in the east. Some of the owners, he said, were foreigners. Much of the bank's business was done in the west. The money paid by Westerners for loans went into the pockets of the Eastern bankers. Jackson said this was wrong. Then the president spoke of his firm belief in the rights of the common man. It is to be regretted, he said, that the rich and powerful bend the acts of the government to their own purposes. Jackson said that instead, the government should shower its favors, as heaven does its rain, on the high and low alike, on the rich and the poor equally. Jackson's veto of the bank bill may have cost him votes among the wealthy, but it earned him votes among the common people, like farmers and laborers. He easily won re-election in November of 1832. Martin Van Buren became his vice president. Historian Daniel Feller says Jackson believed his victory meant that Americans supported his policies, including the bank veto.
He had a very popular personal image. It's possible he would have been reelected by the same margin or larger anyway. The one thing we can say looking forward is that when later on you had somebody carrying on Jackson's policies absolutely faithfully, without Jackson's personal charisma, he proved to be not nearly so popular.
In his second term, Jackson stopped putting federal money into the Bank of the United States. Instead, he put the money into state banks. The bank president, Nicholas Biddle, fought with all his power to keep the bank open. He demanded that borrowers immediately repay their loans. Businesses struggled without the bank's assistance. Workers lost their jobs. Biddle blamed President Jackson for the financial panic. Critics of Jackson's bank policy called him King Andrew I. But as time passed, business people began to see that the Bank of the United States was being much tighter in its money policy than was necessary. They began to feel that it was the bank's president, not Jackson, who was responsible for the serious economic situation in the country. Biddle took no responsibility for the financial crisis. He then made a very bad decision. Biddle asked the governor of Pennsylvania to make a speech supporting the bank. At the same time, Biddle refused to lend the state of Pennsylvania $300,000. The governor was furious. Instead of making a speech supporting the bank, he made one that sharply criticized it. 2 days later, the governor of New York proposed that the state sell $4 or $5 million of stock for loans to help state banks. The New York legislature approved selling even more. Strengthening state banks helped break the power of the Bank of the United States. Nicholas Biddle began to see that the battle was lost. He started making more loans to businesses. The economic panic slowly ended. Jackson's victory over the Bank of the United States was clear. Biddle started to lose the support of many members of Congress. In the House of Representatives, James Polk proposed 4 resolutions about the bank. One said the bank should not get a new charter in 1836. The second resolution said government money should not be deposited in the bank. The third said the government should continue to put its money in state banks. And the fourth proposed an investigation of the bank and the reasons for the economic panic in the country. All 4 of these anti-bank resolutions were approved. One of Biddle's aides described the feelings of bank officials. "This day," he said, "should be ripped from the history of the Republic." He said the President of the United States had seized the public treasury and the representatives of the people had approved it. Jackson won what he himself considered a glorious triumph. Another major event in Jackson's second term was the situation in Texas. The struggle over Texas and the Battle of the Alamo will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.